From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran.
We are prepared to take the steps necessary to return to compliance with the JCPOA, including by lifting sanctions that are inconsistent with the JCPOA.
The U.S. and Iran have begun holding indirect talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal after Donald Trump withdrew from the agreement 3 years ago. We'll speak to former Iranian ambassador and nuclear negotiator Hossein Mousavian. Then we go to Nobel Peace Prize laureate Jody Williams to talk about the Biden administration's decision to leave in place a Trump-era policy allowing military commanders to use landmines across the globe.
Maybe a landmine helps the military for 2 weeks or something, or 2 hours of a battle. But then they go away and they leave them there. And then for generations, literally, people will die when there's no war.
Then vaccine passports?
Not now, nor will we be supporting a system that requires Americans to carry a credential. There will be no federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential.
We'll speak to the ACLU, which warns a lot can go wrong with vaccine passports. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Global coronavirus cases are soaring to levels not seen since January's record peak of infections, led by massive outbreaks across Europe, the Americas, and parts of Asia. India recorded over 126,000 new cases Thursday, a record daily total surpassed only by the U.S., with cases continuing to rise exponentially. Iran recorded its highest ever daily rate of infections for the third consecutive day, with over 22,000 confirmed cases. Iran has struggled to obtain vaccines and has administered only about 200,000 doses to its population of 84 million. Turkey broke its own record for daily infections, reporting over 54,000 cases Wednesday. This comes despite a mass vaccination program, which has reached almost 18 million people, more than a fifth of Turkey's population. In Canada, Ontario Premier Doug Ford has declared a state of emergency, ordering a month-long province-wide remain-at-home order as COVID-19 cases threaten to overwhelm hospitals. Brazil logged 3,800 COVID deaths Wednesday, nearly topping a record high of over 4,000 deaths set a day earlier. Hospitals are running out of basic supplies, including sedatives and oxygen, and Brazil's largest city, Sao Paulo, said it would open 600 new graves per day. This is Paulo Galvão, a doctor at a field hospital in Sao Paulo.
The difficulty I've seen most recently is not only elderly patients arriving, but also many younger patients, 30, 21, 26, 29 years old. These were the worst patients I had yesterday. This is really bad.
On Wednesday, Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, once again refused to order nationwide public health measures and scoffed at opposition politicians who accused him of genocide over his administration's disastrous handling of the pandemic.
Let us not accept the policy of staying at home, of closing everything, lockdown. The virus will not go away. The virus, like others, is here to stay and will remain for a lifetime. It is practically impossible to eradicate it. And until then, what are we going to do?
On Tuesday, Brazil's lower house of Congress passed a bill backed by President Bolsonaro that would allow corporations to directly purchase vaccines on the international market and give them to employees ahead of priority groups, including medical workers and the elderly. The British government Wednesday recommended people under the age of 30 should not receive shots of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine after a European drug regulator described a possible link between the vaccine and rare cases of blood clots. Other European countries have scaled back use of the vaccine in people under 60. About 1 in 100,000 recipients of AstraZeneca's vaccine have reported clotting, 18 cases of which have been fatal. European regulators noted blood clots are a far more common symptom of COVID-19 and that the benefits of AstraZeneca's vaccine continue to far outweigh the risks. This comes as a new study found more than one out of three survivors of severe COVID-19 develop psychiatric or neurological conditions within 6 months of their infection. The United States logged another 75,000 coronavirus infections Wednesday, with hospitalizations at their highest levels in over a month, even as the number of people vaccinated with at least one dose hit 110 million, or a third of the U.S. population. The Centers for Disease Control said the majority of U.S. infections are now caused by the B.1.1.7 variant, first identified in the U.K., which has been found to be more deadly than earlier variants and more transmissible. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said the latest surge is being driven by younger people.
Across the country, we are hearing reports of clusters of cases associated with daycare centers and youth sports. Hospitals are seeing more and more younger adults, those in their 30s and 40s, admitted with severe disease.
Hamas has ordered the Gaza Strip into lockdown after the besieged Palestinian territory confirmed a record number of coronavirus infections. Over a third of the 5,000 coronavirus tests administered in Gaza on Wednesday came back positive. Palestinian authorities have received 40,000 vaccine doses from the United Arab Emirates and 100,000 from China, enough for just a fraction of the 5 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, Israel's top coronavirus official says an outdoor mask mandate will likely be dropped next week after the number of severe COVID-19 cases dropped to a four-month low. Israel implemented the world's fastest mass vaccination program with over 10 million doses administered to date. Over half of Israelis are now fully vaccinated. The Biden administration is restoring U.S. aid to UNRWA, that's the U.N. Relief Agency for Palestinians, after Trump cut its funding in 2018. The U.S. will also provide additional assistance funds to the occupied Palestinian territories, including through USAID programs. President Biden's announcing a series of executive actions on gun control today. They include regulations on so-called ghost guns, home-assembled firearms that don't have serial numbers. He'll also name David Chipman, a gun control advocate, to head the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives. Gun control groups say the measures don't go far enough, but the White House says it's up to Congress to pass certain laws, including universal background checks and banning assault weapons. The executive actions come after deadly mass shootings in Boulder, Colorado, Atlanta, Georgia, and elsewhere. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin wrote in an op-ed on Wednesday, quote, "There's no circumstance in which I will vote to eliminate or weaken the filibuster." Manchin also suggested he would oppose using budget reconciliation again to pass more of President Biden's agenda with just a simple majority. Many Democrats are calling for an end to the filibuster, which they see as the only way to pass major bills in an evenly divided Senate. In Minneapolis, a police use of force expert testified Wednesday that former officer Derek Chauvin employed unreasonable and excessive force against George Floyd last May when he used the full weight of his body to press one knee against Floyd's neck and the other against his back for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Los Angeles Police Sergeant Jody Steger was called as an expert witness for the prosecution.
Mr. Floyd was not resisting. He was in the prone position. He was handcuffed. He was not attempting to evade. He was not attempting to resist. And the pressure that was being caused by the body weight could cause positional asphyxia, which could cause death.
President Trump's campaign and the Republican National Committee issued more than 500,000 refunds to online donors worth over $64 million in the final months of the 2020 campaign after charging recurring payments to people who'd made one-time donations. The New York Times reports one 63-year-old Trump supporter battling cancer had $500 deducted from his bank account every week until his bank account had been depleted and frozen after he failed to opt out of a fine print disclaimer. Donors who tried to cancel recurring payments encountered a message reading, quote, "We need to know we haven't lost you to the radical left. If you uncheck this box, we'll have to tell Trump you're a defector and sided with the Dems." In Georgia, the Fulton County District Attorney will not prosecute State Representative Park Cannon, who was arrested last month for knocking on Republican Governor Brian Kemp's door as he signed a sweeping voter suppression bill. She said the public deserved to witness what was happening. Representative Cannon spoke to CNN last week about her arrest.
It makes me wonder why. Why were they arresting me?
Mm-hmm.
Why were they doing this? Why did the world have to experience another traumatizing arrest?
In related news, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms issued an executive order Tuesday designed to mitigate the impact of Georgia's new voting restrictions. The actions will center on educating voters, helping them obtain identification, and training city staff on how to assist voters. And those are some of the headlines. There is this one. Virginia has become the 16th state to legalize recreational marijuana and the first in the South. Adults 21 and over will be allowed to possess an ounce or less starting July 1st. The bill also includes pro-labor measures and efforts to benefit communities of color that have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs. This is Virginia Democratic Delegate Charnel Herring of Alexandria.
Other states such as Colorado, Vermont, New Jersey, and the past few days, New York, made the same choice. This is because there's a straightforward injustice to punishing people for something we've already agreed should be legal, especially when we know that the punishments are given out inequitably.
In Chicago, Amazon overnight workers walked off the job Wednesday to protest what's known as the mega cycle, the 10.5-hour work shift, which rolled out across the U.S. in the past year, has been devastating for Amazon workers with health issues and those with daytime commitments such as childcare. In related news, the National Labor Relations Board found Amazon illegally fired two workers after they publicly called for the company to address concerns about working conditions at its warehouse and to enact better policies on climate change. And the 2021 Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Independent Media has been awarded to three recipients, the online news outlet Truthout and journalists Liliana Segura and Tim Schwab. Over the past year, Truthout reported on the political, economic, environmental, and racial inequities around the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reporting for The Intercept, Liliana Segura exposed in detail the cruel injustice of capital punishment and the horrific conditions in prisons and the criminal justice system, which all disproportionately affect communities of color and other marginalized people. In a three-part investigation for The Nation, Tim Schwab looked at the secretive operations of the Gates Foundation, revealing how it uses its fortune to influence wide-ranging policy, in particular in the field of public health. The Izzy Award is presented by the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College and is named for the legendary dissident journalist I.F. Stone. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the United States and Iran have begun indirect talks as part of a push to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former President Donald Trump pulled out of the accord nearly 3 years ago. On Tuesday, Iran and the United States began indirect talks in Vienna and agreed to set up two expert-level working groups, along with other signatories of the 2015 deal, which is formally known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. State Department spokesperson Ned Price described the talks as the, quote, start of a process and said the Biden administration is prepared to lift sanctions on Iran.
When it comes to sanctions, the point I made before remains. We are prepared to take the steps necessary to return to compliance with the JCPOA, including by lifting sanctions that are inconsistent with the JCPOA.
The United States has imposed some 1,600 different sanctions on Iran in a move that's made it hard for Iranians to import food and medicine. Iran's deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, told Press TV the lifting of the sanctions must happen before the nuclear deal is revived.
If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance. If we wanted to avoid full compliance to the JCPOA, we would have done it before. We would have totally withdrawn from the JCPOA once the U.S. administration, the previous U.S. administration left the JCPOA. So we are quite serious. Nobody can question Iran's goodwill. The JCPOA is alive because of Iran, and we have paid a heavy price for that.
While Iran formally remains in the JCPOA, it's faced international criticism for increasing production of nuclear materials, though it maintains the production is for peaceful purposes. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu criticized the nuclear deal Wednesday. His comments came a day after Israel attacked an Iranian ship in the Red Sea. We're joined by Syed Hossein Mousavian, a Middle East security and nuclear policy specialist at Princeton University. From 2003 to 2005, he served as spokesperson for Iran in its nuclear negotiations with the European Union. He's the author of several books, including Iran and the United States, An Insider's View on the Failed Past and the Road to Peace. His most recent book, A New Structure for Security, Peace and Cooperation in the Persian Gulf. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you back, Ambassador. Can you start by just explaining the scene in Vienna right now? You have the U.S. at one hotel, Iran at another hotel, and countries and the European Union shuttling back and forth. What are they negotiating this week?
Good morning. Actually, the problem with the current negotiation is that since the U.S. broke the promise, practically the U.S. killed the trust on the Iranian side. Because after 12 years of negotiation, Iran and the U.S., Iran and the world powers, they agreed in 2015 on a deal which is the most comprehensive agreement during the history of non-proliferation. It was working very well, and Iran delivered completely every promise within the deal. Iran was in full compliance with zero failure, and the U.S. withdrew, imposed, not only reimposed the nuclear sanctions, but the U.S. imposed the most comprehensive sanctions ever after the revolution. Therefore, Iranians, frankly speaking, they think they have been deceived by the U.S. They have accepted the most comprehensive commitments during the history of non-proliferation. They have implied, they have complied perfectly. In reward, they have received the most comprehensive sanctions ever after revolution. Therefore, they are coming back to nuclear negotiations with complete mistrust and a feeling of misled and deceived. That's why it's really important if the U.S. wants to revive the nuclear deal, since the U.S. killed the deal, they have to lift the sanctions first. Iran would be ready come to full compliance. Here, there is a big difference. Iran is a member of JCPOA. The U.S. is not. Iran is at least implementing 50% of the JCPOA. The U.S. is at zero implementation. And the U.S. is really the country who killed the deal. That's why the U.S. needs to do some serious steps to revive the trust and to fill the gap already has been created by President Trump.
Ambassador Mousavian, could you explain why it is that U.S. and Iranian officials are not meeting directly, but using intermediaries, the European signatories, to the JCPOA? And also explain what compliance for compliance means. This is a key phrase that's been used in the negotiations. What does that entail?
First of all, Iranians and Americans, they negotiated directly for the first time after revolution in 2013 at a very high level. The foreign ministers, they met, they negotiated, and they played a key role to creating such a deal. The deal practically could never come to a final stage in the absence of Iran-U.S. direct negotiations. Therefore, Iranians already came to negotiation with the U.S., and they accepted the measures, transparency measures, and the limits which no other NPT member has ever accepted during the history of Non-Proliferation Treaty NPT. And they delivered. It was the Iranian goodwill. They wanted to show that they are not after a nuclear bomb and they are ready to accept measures which no other country has ever accepted on transparency measures. But because the U.S. killed the deal, now the Iranians, they say, look, what is the benefit of negotiating with the U.S.? If you negotiate, if you accept the highest level of commitments no other country has ever accepted, if the United Nations Security Council adopt a resolution about the deal, if the International Atomic Energy Agency adopt many resolutions to support the deal, and even if you deliver your commitments, then the U.S. would reward you with the most comprehensive sanctions. Therefore, negotiating with the U.S. is baseless. That's why they have really lost the trust. Second, compliance for compliance means that, first of all, the U.S., during President Obama, was really serious to implement the deal. But even during President Obama, the United States was not in position for full compliance because of primary and secondary sanctions before the nuclear deal. However, Iran remained committed and implemented 100%, while during President Obama, the U.S. was implementing 30% because of the primary and secondary sanctions. Now, President Trump withdrew and imposed not only nuclear sanctions, hundreds of other sanctions far, far, far beyond nuclear. Therefore, now Iranians say, look, we showed our full commitment for full compliance for 3 years nonstop with zero failure. It was you that even you were not able to comply with your commitments during President Obama because of the primary sanctions. Now we have an ocean of new sanctions by President Trump. Therefore, we need to see you would really lift the sanctions. Compliance from the U.S. side is lifting the sanctions. And compliance from the Iranian side is to continue to accept the measures within the JCPOA, which is the most intrusive inspections among all NPT members and the most limits on Iranian nuclear program, like cap on 20% or 90% or 60% enrichment, cap to below 5%, cap to a stockpile, and a lot of other commitments. Therefore, Iranians need to go back to full compliance. It means currently they are complying with 50%. They need to go back from 50 to 100, and the U.S. needs to start from 0 to 100. This is compliance for compliance.
Ambassador Mousavian, you mentioned primary sanctions that were in place before the Trump administration, and you've written also in a piece earlier this year, in addition to saying right now, that primary sanctions must be abolished. Could you explain what those sanctions are and to whom and what they apply and how they differ from the hundreds and hundreds of sanctions that the Trump administration then imposed?
See, before the nuclear deal, the previous U.S. administrations imposed sanctions like sanctioning Iranian oil, sanctioning investment on Iranian oil industry, many other sanctions under the umbrella of terrorism or human rights and so on and so. That's why those sanctions practically blocked any economic relation between the U.S. and Iran. Iran was ready to continue economic relations, trade relations with the U.S., but it was the U.S., because of the sanctions, practically blocked any trade with Iran. However, there are some sanctions even before nuclear deal that the U.S. Has decided for ex-territorial imposing sanctions. It means if the other countries are going to make business with Iran, the U.S. would not make business with them. That's why these are the problems before the nuclear deal. When they came to nuclear deal, based on JCPOA, there is a clear statement in JCPOA saying the signatories, the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council and Germany, they would not do anything to impede normal trade business between other countries and Iran.
Therefore,
the primary sanctions practically blocked the normal trade business between the other countries and Iran. That's why we are saying the primary sanctions are problem, the nuclear sanctions are problem, Trump sanctions are problem. That's why I believe the current U.S. nuclear team, now in Vienna, headed by Robert Mulley, they have really, really difficult, they are in very difficult situation because they have a lot of sanctions which, based on JCPOA, they have to lift it in order to make normal trade business between Iran and the other countries possible.
Can you talk about the real effects of the sanctions on the Iranian people? In headlines today, we read that Iran recorded its highest ever daily rate of infections for another day, 21,000 confirmed cases. There's 84 million Iranians. Only 200,000 vaccine doses have been administered. How do these sanctions affect the health of the people of Iran?
Actually, this has been really a disaster. Thousands of people, they have lost their lives because of the shortage of medicine and medical assistance, medical equipment in the hospitals. There are huge shortage medicine from all over the world. They cannot export medicine to Iran because of the U.S. financial sanctions. And now Iran has the most difficult situation with corona because Iran cannot import any vaccine. Iran cannot import anything to save the life of thousands or tens of thousands of Iranians struggling with corona. Therefore, this is really a humanitarian disaster created by President Trump. Unfortunately, frankly speaking, up to now, President Biden has not been able to remove any humanitarian sanctions, even for Iran to import the vaccines. Therefore, Iranians now, they say President Biden practically is following President Trump's strategy.
And before we conclude, Ambassador Mousavian, could you also comment on the attack on an Iranian military vessel in the Red Sea on Tuesday, which is, of course, the day that these talks began? Both Iranian and U.S. officials suggested that this attack would give credence to those who are opposed to renewing the nuclear deal, to the U.S. returning. What countries are opposed to the deal? Americans and Iranians, in a recent poll, the majority of people in both these countries have expressed support for the deal.
Yes, majority Iranians, they support. Majority Americans, they support. Majority international community, they support. There are only two, three countries which they oppose. First of all, in the U.S., we have hawks. You know them. I don't need to introduce to you. However, Israel is the enemy number one of the nuclear deal. The reason is very simple. The reason is that Israel has tens of nuclear bombs, and they want to prevent any other country, even for peaceful nuclear technology, because if they have enrichment, and if later they decide, they can have nuclear bomb. Israel has nuclear bombs. Israel is not a member of non-proliferation treaty. Israel does not let any inspection to the IAEA to inspect its nuclear facility. While Iran is a member of NPT, Iran does not have nuclear bomb, and Iran is the most inspected country among all the member states of non-proliferation treaty. Still, Israelis are blaming Iran. This is really a joke for international relations, for non-proliferation. A country with nuclear bombs is blaming a country which does not have nuclear bomb, is committed to NPT, has accepted the most comprehensive transparency measures, and is the most inspected country in the world on the nuclear issue. That's why Israelis, they have done everything from the day one to kill nuclear deal. Now Biden is going to return. They are attacking Iranian in Syria. They are attacking Iranian in the oceans in order to force Iran to retaliate, because they believe if Iranians, they would retaliate, would attack the Israelis, then they would be able to drag the U.S. in a military war with Iran. This is the main objective.
Ambassador, we want to thank you so much for spending this time. Ambassador Syed Hussein Mousavian, Middle East Security and Nuclear Policy Specialist at Princeton University. Most recent book, A New Structure for Security, Peace and Cooperation in the Persian Gulf. Next up, we speak to Nobel Peace Prize laureate Jody Williams about the Biden administration's decision to leave in place a Trump-era policy allowing military commanders to use landmines across the globe. Stay with us. For Her by Anne Harris. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The Biden administration is facing criticism from human rights groups for leaving in place a Trump-era policy allowing military commanders to use landmines across the globe. On Monday, a Pentagon spokesperson issued a statement describing landmines as a, quote, vital tool in conventional warfare, and said restricting their use would put American lives at risk. Amnesty International criticized the Biden administration's stance, saying it's deadly and dangerous. In 2014, President Obama banned the military from using landmines anywhere except the Korean Peninsula. But last year, President Trump's defense secretary, Mark Esper, lifted the restrictions on the use of landmines. On Monday, State Department official Stanley Brown confirmed Trump's policy remains in effect.
So right now that policy is in effect, as you all know, and we haven't had any discussions yet in the administration on changing the policy. Basically it removed the geographic restriction of Korea, and now geographic commanders can decide the use of landmines, which is a pretty high bar. So no decision has been made and no study has been done yet.
So the next day, on Tuesday, as criticism grew over the issue, Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby claimed the military is now reviewing the Trump policy. As a candidate, Joe Biden had vowed to promptly roll back what he described as Trump's deeply misguided decision. We're joined now by Jody Williams. She won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for her work with the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. She led the organizing efforts for the landmark Mine Ban Treaty, which prohibits the use, production, transfer, and stockpiling of anti-personnel mines. More than 160 nations have signed the treaty, but the United States has refused to. Jody Williams is also co-founder of the Nobel Women's Initiative. She's joining us from Fredericksburg, Virginia. Jody, welcome back to Democracy Now! There's a new administration, but as of Monday, they said they weren't changing the policy. Then, because of great outcry around landmines, on Tuesday, they said they would review it. Talk about the U.S. and landmines.
Well, as you know, and thank you for having me back, it has been a long process trying to get the United States to join 164 nations and join the treaty. It's perplexing, to say the least. The U.S. has not used, it hasn't exported, it hasn't produced for decades. There have been multitudinous reviews under various presidents. So to have President Biden decide now to have another review is quite mind-boggling. And it is, as Amnesty and others said, a deadly and, I would say, retrograde policy to not immediately move back to the Obama position.
Jody Williams, can you explain what the effects of these landmines are and who, what groups are most vulnerable? Children are, in some places, one in five people who are injured by landmines, and up to 85% of children who are injured by landmines die before they reach the hospital. Could you talk about that, why that's the case, why children are the most vulnerable, and in what countries a landmine are the most widespread?
Sure. Landmines were invented, if you will, in order to maim people. The thought behind that was if you had a unit of soldiers and a soldier stepped on a mine and got blown up, it would upset, freak out the rest of the soldiers in his unit. It would take more blood, more operations to help that person. So when you think about children, how small they are, and stepping on a landmine or picking it up has a devastating effect on kids, older people, women. It is an indiscriminate weapon that has no place on this planet and no place in the ground, in riverbanks where women go and wash clothes, areas where kids play. The fact that President Biden had said he would immediately turn back Mr. Trump's confused policy and is now having another review is very disturbing. Mines are being used now still in Afghanistan, also in Myanmar, a few other countries. I think it's about five these days, but many countries are still clearing the mines that had been laid decades ago. It's a tedious and long-term process to clear landmines.
And in addition to the U.S., Jody Williams, of course, there are other countries that have refused to sign the so-called Ottawa Convention, which limits the use of landmines. Could you explain, talk about what those countries are and where it's known that those countries have deployed landmines, among them Russia, China, India, Pakistan, etc.?
It is true that they have not signed. On the other hand, the pressure of the stigmatization of landmines has had an impact on their policy, except for Pakistan and India. China stopped producing for export back in the 90s. Russia has not used them or exported them either. And this is one of the reasons when we talk about banned treaties that they're so important, is that when the whole world, in essence, is saying that a weapon is illegal, indiscriminate, should be banned, the pressure on countries that don't sign is significant. When India and Pakistan, when their relations get more tense, sometimes along the border, they place mostly anti-vehicle mines. But when tensions go down, they remove them. At least they do that, but they should join the treaty, too.
As a presidential candidate, Joe Biden vowed last year to reverse Trump's policy. In February of 2020, Biden issued this statement to Vox. He said, "The Trump administration's reversal of years of considered decisions by Democratic and Republican presidents to curtail the use of landmines is another reckless act by a president ill-suited to serve as commander-in-chief. It'll put more civilians at risk of being injured by unexploded mines and is unnecessary from a military perspective. As president, I will promptly roll back this deeply misguided decision." That was Joe Biden a year ago. So how do you have then on Monday the Pentagon spokesperson defending the continued use of landmines? And then because of outcry on Tuesday, the Pentagon says, OK, we'll review this.
Certainly is a contradiction and something that those of us who have fought against landmines for decades do not understand. It was fully expected that President Biden would roll back the policy fairly immediately. I've been reading some of the statements of others about it, and Senator Leahy from the great state of Vermont still contends that Biden will reverse the policy. I would suggest to Senator Leahy and others who support banning landmines that they pressure him to do it now and not do another military review. When I heard about the review, I actually, laugh is not the right word, but I was like totally confused because it's been reviewed time and time and time again. How many more reviews does one need to do to know that those weapons have no place on this planet?
Let me ask you something, Jody. Right now, there's this issue of landmines. The U.S. won't sign on to the treaty and says it will continue the policy that Trump promoted. So landmines can be placed beyond Korea. And that's another question, why even in Korea? And at the same time, you have the U.S. being criticized by so many countries around the world for blocking agreements that would allow countries to get vaccines cheaply. So the U.S. will not be a part of ensuring the world can get vaccines, but stands there with those who are pushing landmines around the world.
It is mind-boggling. Again, I can't quite imagine what President Biden is thinking. It is seriously confusing. Let me say, though, the U.S. campaign to ban landmines is putting tremendous pressure on the president and everybody in the administration to change that policy. You know, the U.S. under Mr. Trump, as we all know, tried to withdraw from every international treaty, especially those dealing with weapons. And Mr. Biden had talked about multilateralism and working with the world community and bringing us back into, you know, the international community in a leadership role. You cannot lead from the rear. If you want to really be a leader, you need to deal with the global community, not just your own. So hopefully our pressure will get him to change his mind and ban them now.
Finally, you deal with the issue of killer robots. We don't have much time, but we don't want to skip over this critical area that not a lot of people know about. What are killer robots and what's happening with them now?
Killer robots are a marriage of artificial intelligence and lethal weapons. You take the drone that can fly on its own, at least there is still a human being who sees the target and makes the decision to hit the target. A killer robot has no human being in the loop. They are programmed, they are set free, and then they make the life and death decision over human beings, a machine. Some in the campaign have called it death by machine, you know. It's terrifying. The U.S. has already tested some intelligent munitions that can communicate with each other once they've been fired from an aircraft. And I honestly cannot understand the moral and ethical position of this country that it is okay to allow machines to kill people. It's mind-boggling.
We just have 30 seconds, but you wrote, "Why do we glorify violence and war and make peace seem the folly of fools?"
Think about that all the time. You make a lot of money in war. Peace seems like something for, you know, feather-headed liberals and tree huggers like myself from Vermont. But war is, it's made heroic. It is not heroic. It is devastating. It is death. It is destroyed civilization. It is insane in this planet today where we see with the coronavirus that everything affects everything. It is time to stop war. It is time to work together, around the planet for the greater good of us all. It's my view.
Jody Williams received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for her work to ban landmines with the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. She's co-founder of the Nobel Women's Initiative. Next up, the American Civil Liberties Union is warning a lot can go wrong with vaccine passports. We'll find out how. Stay with us. Minutes to go by the Skatalites. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. To sign up for our daily digest, you can go to democracynow.org or send the word Democracy Now!, one word, text it to 66866 and get our headlines and our stories every day. As people try to find a safe way to gather and travel during the pandemic, there's growing interest in documenting who's been vaccinated or tested negative for COVID-19. On Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced his government will test the use of COVID-19 status certificates. Israel has already been using a green pass system to allow vaccinated people into restaurants and large events, raising concerns about a two-tier system. On Tuesday, the World Health Organization warned so-called vaccine passports may not be an effective way to reopen.
Again, this is why we as WHO are saying at this stage, we would not like to see vaccination as the vaccination passport as a requirement for entry or exit, because we're not certain that at this stage that the vaccine prevents transmission. And there are all those other questions, apart from the question of discrimination against people who are not able to have the vaccine for one reason or another.
Here in the United States, New York is already testing a digital vaccine passport app made by IBM called the Excelsior Pass. Meanwhile, the Republican governors of Florida and Texas have signed executive orders banning vaccine passports. The Biden administration's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said Monday, COVID-19 vaccine passports are, quote, not going to be mandated from the federal government. This comes as the Lancet Medical Journal published an editorial arguing vaccine certificates threaten to exacerbate vaccine inequality and risk, quote, generating hierarchical societies in which vaccinated individuals have exclusive privileges that are denied to those who have not received the vaccine, unquote. As all of this plays out, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, has also raised concerns about vaccine passports. For more, we go to Jay Stanley, senior policy analyst for the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project, who wrote a recent piece headlined, "There's a lot that can go wrong with vaccine passports." Jay, lay it out.
So, first of all, the main push for our country really needs to be trying to get to herd immunity so that COVID becomes another disease like measles or others where we just don't have to worry about it on a daily and hourly basis. Nobody's running around asking us for our measles vaccination certificates left and right. And we want to get to the same point with COVID. That should be the number one goal. And this should be really a sideshow. Of course, there are situations, in our view, where it's legitimate to ask people to prove that they've been vaccinated for various things. Schools have long done that, for example. And perhaps if you're a doctor working with cancer patients who are immunocompromised or a nurse, that could be legitimate. And we have systems in place already for proving you've been vaccinated, notes and paper documents from doctors. And so one question is that system so broken that we need to construct an entirely new electronic system? And if we do, you know, a lot of people have sort of an intuition that, well, in the age of the smartphones, it would be convenient and just make sense to have an electronic version of this that you can have in your phone. But that raises a lot of questions. The first one is equity. A lot of people, 15% of the country, do not have smartphones. Disproportionately, some of our most disadvantaged people, 40% of people over age 65 don't have smartphones. People with disabilities, low-income people are disproportionately lacking in smartphones. And so if you create a system that relies on having a smartphone, you're going to create the kind of two-tiered society that you were quoting people as talking about. There are also questions about privacy. So the idea of having electronic verification and credentialing systems has been around for decades, and there are a lot of different parties that are working on those kinds of a system, whether it's an electronic driver's license, electronic boarding passes, electronic gym memberships, and there are a lot of work being done on creating sort of a unified, standardized system for providing electronic credentials. And this conversation about vaccine credentials is playing into that. And there are different ways that you could build that kind of credential system. And some of them are decentralized, privacy protecting, and empower individuals. So that you go, you get your shot, and the person or the entity that gives you your shot also gives you a certificate printed or on a phone that can prove that you've been vaccinated using cryptography. And then you hold that certificate and you choose whom to show it to. There are other systems for doing digital credentials that are centralized, that are not privacy protecting, and that would, for example, hold a lot of your medical information, create new databases, but would also, every time you show that credential somewhere, would report back to the entity that it's being shown, allowing for the creation of a lot of data about you. And so we think that there has to be a paper option if there's to be any new, more secure system. One of the complaints is that the CDC card that you get is very easily forged. And it's possible to make electronic systems that cannot be forged easily on paper. And so there needs to be a paper option for people so that we don't have these inequities. Finally, you know, we want to make sure that people who cannot get vaccinated are not left out of the system. There are many people who are medically contraindicated. Their doctors have told them because of medical conditions that they have, disabilities that they have, that they shouldn't get a vaccine. It would be dangerous to them. And what happens to them in a society where everybody is running around demanding your passports all the time? Do they get admission to places where non-vaccinated people are excluded because they can't get a vaccine, or are they treated like somebody who has just decided not to get vaccinated? So those are difficult policy issues and difficult technological issues. And it is possible to have a system that is done well, that perhaps increases the security and decreases the ability to, fake vaccine certificates, that is equitable and that does protect privacy, decentralized. And that's the kind of system that if we are going to have something here, it would have to be that. But unfortunately, we don't have a lot of confidence that that's what's going to emerge. One reason is that there are a number of entities out there that are pushing this, big entities with far reach, companies like IBM, MasterCard, the airlines. There are also some nonprofit entities that are pushing the sort of more decentralized privacy protecting schemes. And I think that one of the outcomes here is that we end up with a lot of different systems, and we all have to put five different apps on our phones. And so I think that when the White House originally got involved in this, I think that's what they were trying to avoid, that there be one standard here. I think that that's where we stand.
Jay, could you talk about, some people have drawn a comparison between what's being proposed now by way of a vaccination certification and the World Health Organization's yellow card that provides international proof of yellow fever vaccination. Now, of course, that's a card. It's not digital. Would something like that be safer and more easy to access for more people?
Yeah, I mean, I think that whatever solution is settled upon, if there is a unifying solution, which may not be the case, it has to be simple and paper. There can be secure paper systems that have, for example, QR codes that use cryptography to prevent, forgery, Maybe just the regular CDC cards that we already have is good enough. I mean, is there actually a big problem of forgeries? Is it such a large problem that we need to construct an entire infrastructure requiring individuals to engage in mass adoption, requiring those who give vaccines to adopt software that's standardized, requiring verifying parties, anybody who wants to check a vaccine to get the proper software that interfaces into it? By the time anybody is able to create such a system, we may hopefully we will be at a point of herd immunity. And a lot of this is just going to go away. You're not going to be asked for your vaccination left and right. And hopefully that will never happen. We can just rely on the paper that we have now, which is the CDC card you get when you're vaccinated. We could rely on a more secure paper version, and that involves what's called public key cryptography. So when you get your vaccine, the vaccination place would digitally sign using a private key, an electronic token that would either be put in your phone and could be put in the form of a printed QR code. And they digitally sign that with their private secret digital signature. And then they publish their public key. So it's a private key and a public key that are a matched pair. And that QR code or a phone token can only be read with the public key that was created with that private key. So if I check your vaccine and you give me the QR code, I look at the public key of the person who gave you the vaccine, and if it decrypts your code, then I know that you got your vaccine from a authorized vaccine provider and didn't get this printed out by your uncle in his garage. And I know that it hasn't been altered. And so that's a more secure version that would not have the advantages of a purely electronic system.
Well, we have 5 seconds.
Okay, sorry.
Well, just say clearly we need to discuss this further, and there's a large debate brewing in this country and around the world. Jay Stanley, senior policy analyst for the ACLU, will link to your piece. There's a lot that can go wrong with vaccine passports. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a senior news producer to join our team here in New York City. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.